This episode of See Here is dedicated to Mike. He just doesn't seem to make enough movies, does he?
See Here podcast, episode 53. We've made it to 53. They said we wouldn't make it beyond 49, but they were wrong. On this show, for the first time, we're together as a trio again in quite a few months.
The Mighty Three.
The Mighty Trio. On the left side of my Skype screen, from Seoul in South Korea, doing his farewell jog of South Korea, Mr. Tim Merrill.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
On the right side of my screen, from Bath in England, Mr. Bernard Stickwell.
Good morning. Hello.
We're here to do something that we've not really done much of. I'm trying to think, apart from Allegro Non Troppo, have we ever done a non-English language film?
I don't know if we have, actually.
Oh, well, there you go. We're going to go for that this time. We're going to be discussing a film from 1998 made by a man who you've already gone and implied, Tim, is a little bit prolific. His name is Takashi Miike, and the name of the film is Blues Harp. We'll be talking about that after we listen to the trailer. Back. You're listening to episode 53 of See Here. My name's Morris. I'm over here in Melbourne. Tim is over in Seoul. Bernie's in Bath. So we're here to talk today about a film directed by Takashi Miike. And I was very, very excited to know that he'd made a film that actually fit our creed. And if this is your first time listening to the show, let me just quickly explain the idea behind See Here is that we discuss films that have music in some way or musicians as thematically part of the storyline, be it a documentary or be it a narrative. We've occasionally broken the rules where we've talked about a film that is a musical and the story itself didn't have anything to do with music as such, but it's our podcast. We can do what we like. But this time around, as I said, I was very, very excited to know that a director that I'm pretty sure all three of us hold in high regard, Takashi Miike, had gone and directed a film that fit our modus operandi. The film was called Blues Harp. It was released in 1998. It was written, and let's see if I can pronounce these names without absolutely butchering them, Toshiko Matsuo and Tohiyaki Morioko. It's starring Hiroyuki Ikeuchi as the character called Shuji, Seiichi Tanabe, who played Kenji, and Saori Sekino, who played the character Tokiko. Did I do that right, guys? Good.
You nailed it.
Ah, terrific. Sounded good to me, but what do I know?
All those years of learning Japanese have paid off well. So according to IMDb, the tale is an ambitious Yakuza, Kenji, befriends harmonica-playing bartender Shuji, who moonlights as a part-time drug dealer for the opposing gang. Their friendship is threatened by Kenji's plans for advancements, as well as by his bodyguard's growing jealousy of Shuji. Yeah, okay, that'll suffice, I guess. I should probably also say, fittingly enough, the music for this film was written by one called Atsushi Okuno. Really, I guess I should be talking about the composer, given that we are a music-related podcast.
Yeah.
It seems bizarre that on the one hand that McKay made a film that even remotely qualified for See Here, but I was ecstatic to find that this existed, and one that was not usually part of the conversation when film people discuss his work. Before we get into the themes and details of Blues Heart, let's go around the table, and I want to ask you both, what do you recall was the first McKay film that you saw, and under what circumstances?
I'm not a huge McKay aficionado. I've seen a bunch of his movies, which are pretty much the ones that most people have seen, but I've never really dug any deeper. Mm-hmm. And that certainly isn't because I don't like his work. It's just a bit daunting when he's made, what, over 200 films?
No, he just recently released film number 100.
Still pretty daunting filmography, isn't it? I think the first film of his I saw was probably Audition. And I don't remember, I think somebody basically lent me the DVD. When did Audition come out?
Audition probably came out around 99 to 2000, around that, I think.
Yeah, that sounds more like it. Yeah, yeah. I saw that and very much enjoyed it, and I still like it very much. I'd say it's one of my favourite of his movies that I have seen. And I've seen G the Killer and Gozu and Visitor Q, and I must have seen a few others, but those are the ones that kind of spring to mind immediately. So fully aware of the man and his work, but just haven't explored it that much. And I got to say, I was kind of pleased when Morris picked this film, because as you say, Morris, it's kind of like, oh wow, McKay made a film that's got a kind of musical theme to it, which you wouldn't necessarily expect. But at the same time, I kind of wasn't surprised, because he seems to have dabbled in pretty much everything. So I'm looking forward to talking about this one.
Wait a minute, Visitor Q, wasn't that his Disney tribute? Yeah.
Fun Never for mind. All the family, literally.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I think the first thing that I saw of McKay's actually was in the theater. Back in Midnight Madness, they showed Fudo, The Next Generation, which was an earlier film that came out before Blues Harp, and that was based on a manga. And then I think when I came over to Korea, I had a friend of mine, Jason, and I, we used to swap stuff with people abroad in the early days of the internet. And I got a VCD of this McKay film called Full Metal Yakuza, or Full Metal Gokuda. Mm-hmm. And that was one of his direct-to-DTVs, what they call them, direct-to-video, because he was actually a pretty prolific DTV guy before he got into film. And I think after Fudo, the first feature that he did, like Bernie, I saw Audition. And after Audition, it was Dead or Alive series,
right,
then Visitor 2, and then, you know, later on, Geechee and everything. And I think one way that a friend of mine, Mark Schilling, he's a journalist in Tokyo, and he's been writing for years and years and years on Japanese cinema. And Mark actually agreed with me. I was amazed in my assessment, where I said that I thought you have to look at McKay as a director, as somebody behind the wheel of a car or a motorcycle. Every film that he does is him deciding to basically operate at a certain speed. And what I mean by that is that some of his films are this full throttle, and some of his films are very slow and methodical. You know, they cruise along. But it all depends on what speed he wants to basically operate at. His fan base is so varied, because I know there's a lot of people that like his very full-on, right to the red line, right to the limit, stuff like Visitor Q and Ichi. And then there's other people that appreciate his more jaunty stuff, like, you know, Zebra Man or the Yokai remake that he did, and the Katakuris. It's like a journey. Instead of your eyeballs are locked right into the dashboard, you're going to die at any minute. I mean, like, that's what a lot of people associate with McKay, is that full throttle. But like I say, he operates at different speeds, and it all depends on what he's saying and where he wants to take you. If you look at him like that, he makes perfect sense, because a lot of people say, you can't pigeonhole this guy. Where is he going to go next? And it's just like, well, wherever he wants to take you.
It seems to me that a lot of the articles that I've read and a lot of the conversations on the film forums seem to really do focus on the transgressive stuff that he does. And, you know, the films that you've already gone and mentioned, like, you know, Ichi the Killer and Audition and Gozu, you know, the very, very transgressive, very full-on stuff. And I like the fact that you've mentioned there, Tim, that the one consistency in his oeuvre is diversity. The first film that I went went to see him, and I'm, as per usual, I came on late onto the bandwagon, but in 2011, there was the cinematic release of his remake of the film Harakiri, Death of a Samurai. So I went with Max to see that, and it was maybe a little unusual in that it was a theatre watch, and I gather that most people, purely by virtue of the fact that he's made so many films, have only had the opportunity to see him or his work on DVD, Blu-ray, streaming, just home video, and wasn't the sort of film that was in the typical conversation. This wasn't a transgressive film. It wasn't overly violent, and it wasn't of a transgressive sexual nature like something like Visitor Q is. So really, to that degree, I think I've only seen maybe about 10% of Mikkei's output, but that's about a dozen films. I've yet to see a film I didn't like, and I'd like to think that a lot of what I've seen has been quite diverse. And I really come onto this saying, I've never had the nerve to watch Ichi the Killer. We once had a conversation, Tim, where you said to me, look, if you've watched Visitor Q, that's more transgressive than Ichi the Killer is. It's just different. But yeah, Visitor Q is
Ichi's
definitely...
almost just cartoonish in its...
Right, absolutely.
Well, in its way, sort of Visitor Q is as well. But I mean, I know what you're saying, like, cartoonish in its violence, but Visitor Q had these moments that were just so ridiculous that you couldn't take it seriously.
Ichi was based on a manga, right? It was based on, you know, comic books to begin with, whereas Visitor Q was a story that was written separate.
Right.
But one thing that I really appreciate, though, about everything that Mikkei's ever done is the fact that when you look at a lot of the major studio directors in any country, they basically have to toe the line to basically satisfy the tastes of the general public. Whereas Mikkei has said, look, this is what I'm serving. You can eat it or you can fucking starve. I don't give a shit. But I think that he's drawn people into, he's made things that have been interesting enough, alluring enough, that have been well-constructed enough. He's really kind of made himself a trademark name to the point of where people will say, I don't know exactly what he's going to do, but I know it's going to be interesting. And I'm in, just based on the fact of what he's done before. For his pedigree.
Technically a very good director. He's always coming up with something that's interesting.
It's interesting to him. He's not saying, well, what am I going to do that's going to draw everybody in? He's saying, no. This is what I want to do. Like, this is what I think is really interesting and cool. And if you think it's interesting and cool too, you're going to like it. If you don't, well, tough shit. I don't care.
He's almost like a Japanese Woody Allen in that he's just obviously compelled to make films and this is what he does.
Sure.
You almost get the impression once he's made a film, he's not really that fussed what happens to it because he's already on to the next one.
Exactly.
So it's just, you know, it's in his blood. It's what he does.
I guess, though, the difference between what he does and what Woody Allen does is Woody has just found different ways of telling, it's maybe a little bit unfair, but he's found different ways of telling the same or a similar story.
Absolutely.
You know, with a few exceptions, but over the last 20 years, even if you don't watch the opening titles, you will pick within 5 minutes. Oh yeah, this is a Woody Allen film.
Yeah. Oh yeah, his sphere of circle of interest is a lot smaller than Mikkei's.
Mikkei
will tackle pretty much anything, won't he?
Probably my favourite Mikkei film out of the dozen or so that I've seen is The Bird People in China. Watching that, you would really not think that that is a Mikkei film at all. I almost sort of think it's like a gentle Yakuza meets Northern Exposure type of film. It's this fantastical element. Yeah, there's a Yakuza theme in there, but that's not what the focus of the film is supposed to be about. Mm-hmm. That's as gentle as it comes. Diversity alone isn't enough to make a great filmmaker. It's certainly an admirable trope, but he says, I'm a storyteller first, and I'm interested in all sorts of stories. Like, you know, Tim, you've often gone and made the analogy of, I don't just like eating this type of meal, I like eating that type of meal. And that works so much for Mikkei's output.
This is going to sound funny to you guys, maybe, but when I think of Mikkei, for some weird reason, and maybe I was off my head one night watching something I had been in my cups, but I immediately thought of something like The Hunchback of Notre Dame, like Charles Laughton, or The Phantom of the Opera, in the sense that there's a real beauty, there's a real kind of honesty and a real humanity in ugliness. He has this ability to shove your face into broken glass or a pile of shit and show you the beautiful aspects of the worst elements of humanity. And he does this again and again and again in different ways. Even with Visitor Q, where you laugh at things that you actually almost like want to hit yourself for laughing at. He has this incredible ability to show integrity and show beauty, just show really honest humanity. He goes to the highest or the most extreme elements to really show true humanity.
He doesn't wallow in it, does he? Even though in a way he does, it's not there. It's not like misery porn. Because, I mean, elements, to bring it back to a Blues Harp, I mean, just the kind of setting, you know, it's in a poor area. People, it's a rundown, sort of fairly scabby little kind of seaside port town by the look of it.
Osaka. Yeah.
But it's not misery porn, is it? The main guy is a drug dealer. The other main guy is a gangster. These are people who are traditionally in movies are fairly shitty and leading sort of crappy, unpleasant, violent lives. But
well, they sort of are. But I just wanted to make one contrast to a man who I know is Miike's hero, and that's Kenji Fukasaku, who, you know, most famously directed The Battles Without Honor and Humanity set of films. Fukasaku had been on the record for saying that he wasn't really happy with a lot of the Yakuza films that had come before him, and I really wish I knew which ones in specific he was referring to. But he said that he felt that a lot of those films tended to give some level of honor and respect to the gangster culture, at least, you know, not necessarily painting them to be completely favorable, but saying that they're tough guys, but you got to respect them. And in his films, he basically said, no, you don't have to respect them. They're the lowest of the low. They've gone and ruined a lot of society. There's no character in the films that I've seen that's sympathetic. There's, you know, I think one character who you maybe sort of think, okay, this guy's got a little bit of a more level head than the rest of them, but pretty much I could see that creator of The Sopranos would have to have been a big fan of you're thinking The Wire. Think of it later. But really, the whole thing about The Sopranos is, you know, everybody's a shit. Yeah. You can respect that they have what they're doing makes business sense, but no one has any humanity. Well, and that's the same thing in Battles Without Honor and Humanity. And yet, I think that to an extent in his Yakuza films, Miike also goes by that thing that, no, these people are characters that you need to sympathize with, but it's still not black and white. Even in some person who can be absolutely horrid, they might still, I don't know, pat a dog. Yeah.
But, you know, this all goes back to, you know, Peckinpah, too, with the Wild Bunch. Because, I mean, the Wild Bunch was exactly the same thing, where Peckinpah said, you know, like the whole mythos of the West and the way that you'd hear a pop and somebody would fall off a horse and, you know, that there was good guys and bad guys and it was all binary. And he was saying that's all a bunch of shit. Everybody's deplorable in the Wild Bunch. And, I mean, you know, and everybody gets their comeuppance. It's like when we think of humanity, sometimes people are kind of misconstrued and thinking that humanity means that everyone's virtuous, and it's not. Yeah, we all have human elements to us, but it's all in a matter of degrees. I mean, we can still be pretty deplorable people, but still have emotions. We just choose not to use them, right?
Let's talk about Blues Harp itself. A couple of articles that I'd read had gone and compared Blues Harp to the Black Society trilogy. And I think this is sort of a little bit superficial because you know, they're Yakuza films, this is a Yakuza film. But I found particularly the Black Shinjuku Society, the first of the trilogy, was definitely a film that I would say is transgressive and very violent and very, very cruel, very, very nasty. The other two aren't quite nasty in that regard, but they're sort of sad tales. I almost see, in some ways, Blues Harp to be, maybe happy is not quite the right word, but very hopeful in a lot of ways. My first thought watching the film was that the music connection was going to be a little bit superficial as far as the podcast goes. But after watching it a couple of times, it occurred to me that it really was a very see here type of film. There are films that we've all watched that talk about the so-called power of music, and whatever other problems we have in life, the power of music will get us through. And, you know, I mean, two examples that we've discussed on the program, We Are the Best and Good Vibrations. In both those films, you know, the love of music superseded whatever it was, you know, religious or political violence and the drudgery of the main character's existence and what society expected of them. In Blues Harp, the power of music angle is not pushed as much to the front. There's a lot of subtlety in this film, but I think that any scene in this film that's of a positive nature is set in the bar around the music. Those scenes convey joy and they're really focal points of positive developments for Shuji. I mean, it's where he meets Takiko, who he ends up falling in love with and having a relationship with. He gets pulled out of his shell to actually play the harmonica with the house band in front of an audience instead of just sitting around and playing it for himself, because he's very, very much an introvert. And this is sort of conveyed at the beginning of the film. We'll come to that shortly. No doubt. Later on in the film, he truly comes into his own, where he gains full confidence. He's leading the band once the main singer of the band says, I've got to bow out. And Shuji becomes this great figure of confidence. So there's also Kenji's story as the Yakuza, and he's basically trying to sort of climb up the corporate ladder, as it were, within the Yakuza and become a boss through deception and deceit. I mean, that's a fascinating story. But anything that's positive and hopeful out of this film revolves around music. And I also got to say that I got myself very, very excited at one point in the film where I'm listening to a tune, I'm thinking, hang on, I know that song.
Harvey Bruce.
I know, yeah. I know exactly what you're going to say.
New Coat of Paint, the Tom Waits song, yeah. Being sung in Japanese. Oh, yes. I love that so much.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things that initially hit me with this film. Is like, first off, this film could have been a really, really short film, you know, because, you know, you could have subtitled this film Blues Harp, a.k.a. There he is, the end. Because, I mean, the way it starts out, Chiji, he makes a choice, and that's where it goes. But this reminded me, this film, this was the first time I'd seen this, and it reminded me almost of like a 50s American film. You're in a jazz bar with that sax player, and the sax player just happens to know a guy in the neighborhood who's a gangster, and it's like a noir. Like, it really reminded me of the whole noir concept in a way.
I was going to say the same thing, Tim. It's very much about a person who, through the choice they make, they get into a certain situation,
right,
and then fate just takes over.
Right. Not to go too far ahead, but I think that what I was saying earlier about, you know, Miike in his way that the metaphor of him driving a car, driving fast or driving slow or whatever, I think that there's three different speeds in this film, actually. Whereas you get Chiji, the main bartender guy, and he's more of a laid back and very kind of placid type of dude. And then you get the guy who's the singer of the band, who's supposed to be the front man and all that, and he's kind of a neutral guy, where eventually he gets to a point where he says, look, man, I'm out. My dad's sick and I've got to raise my family and do what's right. And then you get the gangster dude, and Kenji's full on speed, man. He's just like this little piranha, just like, nah. You can just see he's just this coiled ball of tension through the whole film. And he's taking showers all the time, and you just see him just this writhing in the shower, just like this.
Yeah, there's kind of a reason for that, though, isn't there?
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
But it's just, he's this coiled up ball of tension, and I see these three speeds in the film. And it's
interesting,
just,
as you were saying earlier, Tim, your kind of theory with Miike and the speeds at which he goes. Yeah. The opening of Blues Harp, that whole sequence where Kenji is being chased, beaten up and chased by some other gangsters, that's proper, full-on, kinetic, violent, fast-paced Miike, isn't it? It just, Miike, the killer. But then that opening is very much in that style. But then there are moments in the film which are really sort of quiet and still.
Oh, yeah. Shots and they reminded me of Kurosawa. Another one that was in a Miike film was they reminded me this one shot of the little boy with his father walking on, like walking towards the beach. It reminded me of, have you guys ever seen the film Sonnentin?
Of course,
It reminded me of Sonnentin.
Yes. Oh, is that fireworks?
You're talking about Hanabi. That's Hanabi.
Hanabi. Yeah. Is that the one with the father walking with his son to the beach? I thought that was that one.
Maybe it was. No. I'm confused. Either Sonnentin or Hanabi.
Is it Kikujiro you're thinking of, Tim? That's the one with the little boy, isn't it? And
right.
The father.
Yeah, right, it's right, Kikujiro. Right. Yeah. Okay. But it was just, I seen that shot, though, in Blues Harbor. And, well, wait a minute. I've seen this before. I've totally seen this before. Like, this reminds me of something else. Not that it's a complaint against the film or anything, but I think because this is an earlier Miike film, he's still learning to transition into film, I think, because there's a lot of stuff in this film that is kind of a lot of what you would consider to be like direct-to-video type of stuff. There's a lot of video edits and a lot of almost like music video type stuff.
Yeah.
It's almost like Video Toaster. Used to be a program called Video Toaster where you could do just experimental cuts and edits and swipes and all. It just seems like it's really a mixture of so many things. This film, as much as he's telling a story that's there, and the story is valid, the process that he uses to go through the whole thing is really kinetic because he just uses so many different things. At the beginning of the film, there's these fast cuts that look almost pornographic because if you look at them for a split second, what the hell's going on there? And then later on, it's a shot of Kenji brushing his teeth.
But yeah, I see what you mean. It's kind of foreshadowing what's going on, but it is a very 90s look at me with my new editing software kind of thing, isn't it? I think there's definitely elements of that in this, but I don't know. I think it is quite a mature film in a way as well, because it certainly goes deeper than its surface would maybe indicate.
I think this is the sort of film that's going to warrant a lot of views. This is one I think I'll be coming back to quite a lot. You know, something like Audition, don't get me wrong, I adore it, but it's the sort of film I think I could only watch once in a while. This is something that even through two views, I got something more the second time around, even than I did the first time around. And as you say, Bernie, I think it's a very mature film for a filmmaker who was still early days. You know, he hadn't really made that many. He'd made like a few direct-to-video things, and this might have been fairly early in his feature films. I see what you're talking about with the whole video clip look in that early scene, but that's a minority part of the film.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's a huge part of the film. There are moments like that, but I don't think he overdoes it.
No, I like the parts when he was actually cutting up the video games with the actual violence.
Yeah, that was
good. I thought that was really sharp, the way that they're playing Street Fighter and you're seeing the guy getting kicked and he's really getting kicked. I mean, like, I just thought it was kind of neat the way he kind of diced that up.
There's that weird scene later on as well in the film where Chuji is in the diner talking to some gangster guy and it goes into this really weird slow motion choppy video effects. You know the scene I mean?
And
it was almost like a weird time lapse thing, and that really didn't seem to make much sense as to why he was doing that at that point.
I think that the very opening scene of the Tim, what you mentioned there with the violence and the chase scene with Kenji, was the second scene of the film, the very first scene of the film, where we see Shuji as, I don't know, an 8, 9, 10 year old.
A little kid.
As a little kid. And like that opening minute, I thought, all right, you've gone and hooked me. I know I'm going to love the rest of the film.
Shuji. Huh? 学校は?
夏休みだよ, ママ.
In case you haven't seen the film out there, let me set this up for you. So it's set on Okinawa. We get a long shot of a street on the wrong side of town, or maybe it's the only side of town, but it's fairly poor. And we hear a simple melody being played on the harmonica by this young boy, Shuji. And it's obviously a hot summer's day. He's sitting out there, just sitting in his shorts and singlet. And he's playing this simple melody. We see a truck come from the distance, and it's driving up to his house. Shuji's mother comes out, and she's flirting with him. She sees Shuji and says, "Shouldn't you be at school?" And he says, "But mother, it's school holidays. She didn't even remember. She just goes inside, and then we see a plane fly overhead with the camera on the ground level looking up at Shuji, and we see the plane flying overhead. In that 60 seconds to 2 minutes, we already know a ton of things. We know that he's neglected. We know that he's an introvert and probably has no friends, and the only thing that keeps him going is the simple joy of music, and the plane is, you know, metaphorical. And it's not unique, I admit, to Mikkei, but he does it extremely well with a shot where the plane flying overhead is the unattainable. It's the plane going somewhere else to possibly a better life, which, you know, obviously is a metaphor that they use all the time in films with trains. But this plane, it might be just flying over his head, but it's completely out of his reach. And we've already learnt within 60 seconds or 2 minutes so much. Mikkei has gone, given us so much information, and it's not the only time he does this in the film. And I'll probably bring up another couple of instances where he does it, I think, very, very subtly. It's not punched in your face for a director who we know for his transgressive cinema and being extremely violent or extremely sexually kinky, or however you want to put it. He shows a lot of great restraint in this film. And as we've already gone and said, this is an early film, and maybe he was yet to decide that he was going to be transgressive, but he has gone back and forward, as you've already gone and said to him. He has lots of different stories to tell, and he has lots of different speeds that he's going to go at it. And I just love how in this film he does show all the speeds, as you've gone and said, and this opening is just such a beautiful opening to a film.
It's a real masterclass in how to pull that whole everything you need to know about that character in sort of under 2 minutes in a beautifully shot little vignette right at the start of the film. That is just, you know, that's somebody who really understands how film works. It's just absolutely beautiful, isn't it?
And the contrast between that and the visceral nature of the scene that you've already described, the sort of MTV video look of the chase scene, this gang chasing Kenji down the street and them getting into this very, very violent fight, and intercut with shots of the bar where the blues band is playing. It shows that both these men, as we'll get to meet them throughout the film, have their different approach to what's visceral and to what's exciting. So in one case, Kenji finds his way through wanting to be the head honcho of a violent Yakuza family, and he's going to go through a lot of pain to do it. Shuji, he likes the music. He likes being in the bar, and he's just happy to let life pass him by. He's challenged later on by saying, well, you do something artistically. But I love how we get those contrasts within that 2 minute or 3 minute scene, and that contrast itself to the opening scene where we see Shuji for the first time. And you use the perfect words there, Bernie, masterclass in filmmaking.
The story is not a new story by any means. Like I said, you know, it can go back to like the 40s or 50s or hardcore noir, but in all of these certain films, it always winds up with somebody being injured and somebody else deciding to help them. Right. And it's just like, you get to the point where like, look, dude, nobody ever asked, why did you get hurt? You know, why did they do this to you? Like, why did you get fucked up? You know, it's like, oh, okay, then forget it. I'm not going to have anything to do with you. No, they immediately get drawn into helping these people, and then they become their best friends by helping them, and then it all goes to shit from there.
That's the dramatic device, though, isn't it? You know, as soon as Shuji sees Kenji in the alleyway and he decides not to give him up, you just know that where the whole film is going. It's like, this is going to come back and bite him in the ass big time.
Right. And in that one scene, there's a part that, as you're implying there, Tim, doesn't make much sense, because Shuji won't give him up despite the fact that these people who are chasing him are part of the gang that Shuji sells drugs for. So he actually has a connection to them. And yet the part that does make complete sense is within Japanese society, we hear a lot about honor and doing the right thing by someone who's looked after you. So Kenji feels duty bound throughout the film to look after him and to help him out.
But the biggest mistake that Shuji made is helping him to begin with, you know?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
あ、あれ、あんたが花村組のケンジってクソ。
お前、あいつらと関係あんのか？
But I was going to say also that I think the club itself is very symbolic, because I think the club itself is symbolic of youth. When the old singer of the band, he says, I don't know how long I can pass off being young. What does he say? He says, I've spent too much time doing things for myself.
ガキもそろそろ幼稚園だしな。俺ほら、十分勝手なことやってきたから。
I've got to do things for everybody else now. Like, I've got to go on. And then when you see the owner of the club, there's one time where he's actually sitting there by himself playing a little tune on the guitar. ¶¶ And it's almost like he's going back to a moment where, you know, he remembers the joy that he had.
The tune that he's playing is actually quite melancholy, isn't it?
Right.
So it's kind of reflected through that.
It's a lament of
youth. I think there's that great scene where the singer of the band is talking to Shuji and trying to persuade him to, you know, take his spot, basically. And as you say, he's kind of talking about how he's having to grow up and look after his family and so on. Whilst they're sort of having that conversation, they're having it on the roof of the club, like a couple of teenagers. They're both dressed like a couple of teenagers. I mean, Shuji's probably in his 20s. This other guy is probably 30s, 40s. And there's a bit where the singer, he's got a baseball and he just kind of throws it casually.
Yeah, he breaks something.
Break. And he's like, oh no, sorry. And
yeah, it's just, I apologize.
It's such a teenage thing to do whilst having that conversation. That's such a beautifully observed and put together scene, I think. I thought that was really good.
This is the elephant in the room for the film. And I'm not going to give away any spoilers, but I'm going to ask you guys a question. And you can answer yes or no. Was there a little bit of a love triangle going on in this?
Of course there was.
I don't think it's giving anything away to know that the gay subtext in this film, it's not exactly in your face, but it's a little bit more than just being subtle. There's a scene early on in the film after Shuji has gone and rescued Kenji and Tokiko has gone and patched him up that we see Kenji looking at Shuji sleeping in his bed, and Shuji is sleeping there completely bare-assed, and he's staring at him. Also, remember there's a scene later on where the two of them are speaking to each other in a field, and Kenji is saying, here's some money, I'm going to look after you. And he says, tell me, do you like me?
What? You like me? Huh? You like
me? Ah, I like you.
Shuji says, yeah, sure, I like you. And Kenji says to him, you just don't understand what I'm asking you.
He's putting him in the friend zone.
Right.
It's to Mikkei's credit that he does that. I mean, obviously, we're talking about those scenes now, but it's done quite slowly and subtly throughout the film, and he just drops these little hints. But it's actually a really important part of the story because a certain other person who may have interest in certain other characters kind of engineers a situation which leads to the, again, I don't want to give anything away, but it leads to the kind of climax of the film and things kind of wind up going kind of pretty much pear-shaped. And that is all down because somebody has feelings for somebody else that might not be reciprocated, shall we say.
Right.
But I think it's really beautifully and subtly done up to a point. And I'll be completely honest with you. There was a point in the film where a light bulb just went on over my head and I was like, oh shit, okay, I get it, I understand now. You know, my gaydar is not very good anyway, according to my wife, but it's really nicely done.
I'll bring up one more point that sort of says, if you haven't picked it up yet, here's another indication. Kenji is having sex with his boss's wife as a way of getting an in to plant his way as becoming the boss of that particular Yakuza clan. And I think, was it Bernie already mentioned this, that after every sex scene that where Kenji's having sex with the boss's wife, he goes into the shower, he's vigorously brushing
his teeth. Well, no, he is later. That the first time you see that happen, he's just in the shower and brushing his teeth. Actually, I don't think you even see him in the shower. He's just brushing his teeth.
Well, no, you do see him in the shower, and he's brushing really vigorously. What Mikkei does is there gets to be a point, and once again, I'll try not to spoil this, but the boss's wife comes to a certain realization at a later point in the film, which if she'd come to this realization after the first time that Kenji has a shower in the film, I don't think it would have been as effective. But it's like you tell a joke, there's always three iterations before we get to the punchline. And in this film, we get three showers that Kenji has. And the first time we're sort of thinking, oh, he's brushing his teeth a bit vigorously, maybe he likes oral hygiene. But every time we're sort of realizing, oh no, he's trying to scrub himself clean.
The first shower scene, the first time that happens, I didn't get that from it. It's only the second and the third time where it's pretty much explicit what's going on. So like I say, this is me dropping these hints. And if you're an observant viewer, like you were saying, Tim, the very start of the film, you get all those quick edits, which are almost like foreshadowing things. One of those is Kenji brushing his teeth, isn't it?
There's the one time where Kenji Denji goes after one of the guys from the opposing gang and he says, hey, we don't put up with speed. We don't put up with that shit. But I think that Kenji's a speedhead himself, like through the whole thing. And I think because his nature, he's so highly energetic.
He's impatient, isn't he? He needs to get things going. Yeah, he wants to
climb that ladder. But he almost seems like a speedhead. He acts before he thinks. And I think that him brushing his teeth, too, initially the first time, I thought, that's just because he's on speed, man. He's on crank. And he's just going, and I just thought, you know, he's on meth. Like, he's just cranking out. That's what initially what I thought. But then later, when he's actually dry heaving and everything, she's watching him empty his guts. I'm going, okay.
Like Shuji, Kenji is also something of an outsider. You know, right. With Shuji, it seems more obvious because he's just got this harmonica as a friend almost. But with Kenji, he's an outsider because he's gay in a society, and I mean not Japanese society, but within the Yakuza, where I imagine revealing his true nature would not only be dangerous for him, but it would certainly get in the way of his plans of leading that Yakuza clan. I think you started off this part of the conversation, Tim, by saying there's something of a love triangle here, and there is and there isn't. So Tokiko, who ends up becoming Shuji's girlfriend, she's the third part of this triangle, and yet she's not really part of the love triangle because Kenji is not really jealous of her. She saved him by stitching his wound, so he's on a bound to save her.
He's kind of resentful. Chiji, you know, is with her. I mean, Chiji's with her, but he don't eat lunch at the Y.
Chiji's not even aware, though, is he? I think of Kenji's feelings towards him that way. So
The way he's so flippant to Chiji, like he says, so what's her name again? This is his best mate. He should know his girlfriend's name. He just knows her from a distance, like she's nothing.
And yet there's this scene later on where he comes into the bar and, you know, Tokiko is obviously Shuji's biggest fan and a huge encouragement to him. No, get out and play that harmonica. Oh, you're getting a record contract. Yeah, go for that. And so there's a scene where Kenji comes into the bar while a band is playing and he watches Shuji almost wistfully, but he says to Kiko, look, I think I'm gonna go. I don't really belong here. I'm dressed differently to the rest, but you know, you have a nice time. And I think at that point he sort of says, you know what, you being with him, that's what has to be. I'm quite all right with that.
Exactly. I laughed at that one bit though, where, you know, the old singer of the band, he says to Shuji, you know, come on up here, man, like, you're great, and she's the only one clapping and she doesn't stop. It's a big club, but then when you realize it's like a basement, she's the only one clapping, and he's just like, stop clapping, stop clapping, like, god damn it. And then he goes up there and starts like pulling out this like Paul Butterfield type shit.
There's one moment in the film I think that you of all people will particularly appreciate, Tim. The record that sort of brings them together is the essential Little Walter.
Oh yeah, exactly. Like, he was pouring through the stacks and he's just like, okay, yeah, this is it.
But no, just goes to show as well, the vinyl never went out of fashion in Japan, because this is what, 97, 98, you go anywhere else in the Western world, it's all CDs. But in Japan, there's this huge record shop that he's going through and across that record.
And it so happens that his girlfriend's working at the counter.
Yeah.
Maybe this is me being a little nitpicky. I always laugh at these films where they always try to capture audience reactions to live acts. And they always overdo it with the audience. It's like they've electrified the floor and everybody's just jumping up and down so they don't get shocked.
Yeah.
And it's like what they're playing and how the audience is reacting to it is not kind of really relative, right? I've never seen a film that could ever do it. And I'm not trying to be racist or bigoted any matter by saying this, but it always seems whenever I see like foreign films and they film like live music in a club, it always seems like everybody's just going overboard. You know, Argeno or Fulci or any of these guys that a rock band's playing, it's like everybody's on PCP or something.
So Mike's probably going, come on, more energy, people, show me, come on.
Yeah,
and they're all dancing like the opening credits of Friends.
Maybe he's got a prop pistol with blanks in it and he's just pointing it at the crowd. Dance.
You know what, I think in this film I don't see that as a problem, because I think that Mike also wanted to make a point about the confidence levels of the two characters. So sometimes you have to accentuate something to make your point. And in this film, we see like Kenji's confidence. It should be more than what it is, but because he's an outsider in this Yakuza society, he never really shows the confidence that you would imagine for someone who is trying to get to the top of that corporate tree. And yet we see Shuji, who really is very insular, and yet once he starts playing the harmonica in front of a crowd that loves him and says, yeah, give us more, play us that tune, that he really comes into himself. So I think that getting that audience behind him, saying maybe they just thought, yeah, oh, Shuji, our bartender, the guy who we've been buying drinks for ages, go and play us a tune, Shuji. And I think that it wouldn't have worked quite as well if they hadn't had the floor electrified under them. I think in this case, I'm really prepared to let Mikkei have a pass because I see what it is that he's trying to do there. And I think it's actually really very, very warranted in this case.
Right. What you just mentioned about saying that Kenji, he's trying to climb the corporate ladder, but he's not really part of it. They even say that to him. There's a bit where he's sitting there by the river with the other gangster, and the other gangster says, you know, you're the most fucking dishonorable Yakuza I've ever met. What's ironic is that the guy's seeing him as persona non grata in terms of the social structure of the Yakuza, but at the same time, like you said earlier, the guy doesn't know that he's also gay, which is even further out there. So I think that's kind of interesting as well. You know, he's a rebel, but you don't even know how much of a rebel he is. You don't even know how far he is out there, you know?
Then it speaks volumes for the Yakuza. That gangster guy who was pointing that out to him is then very happy to go along with this plan that they've both concocted so that he can benefit from it as well. Yeah, the honor thing's a little bit bullshit, really.
And it goes back to what Morris was saying about, you know, with Fukusaku, about everybody being a bottom feeder, everybody being a backbiter, and that's what it is. And I mean, even the only one, well, the only two that aren't really involved in any of this shit is really like Gigi and his girlfriend, because I mean, like, you know, he's dealing drugs, okay? So you could say he's incriminated in that sense. He doesn't even know what he's getting duped into.
No, particularly as it gets towards the end of the film.
Right,
and
he doesn't know.
Yeah.
Whereas everybody else is just basically crossing them, double-crossing, and, you know, everybody's out for themselves. He's just trying to get out with his girlfriend, you know, and the baby, and trying to do what's right.
Well, this is the like the noir aspect as well, isn't it? It's just the fates conspiring against him.
And you do see the one guy get out, the old singer of the band, where he's on the Greyhound bus with his wife and his kid, and you see him leave. He's the guy that does it right.
Yeah, but then he's not mixed up with the Yakuza, is he? He's not in that situation. He's just leaving that life for another one,
One more thing I wanted to point out before we sort of like do a bit of a wrap up, and I know that for a film that seemed like it had such a straight ahead story, there are so many aspects to this, and this is a conversation that if we wanted to explore every aspect, we could be going on for hours, but hopefully we've given enough of a taste to the listeners out there who haven't seen it to go pick it up. I don't think that we've gone and spoiled it too much, and even if we have, this really is a film about the journey as much as it is as to how it gets resolved, and we haven't gone and given anything away in that regard, how it gets resolved. And hopefully we've given enough of the flavour of the story and that there's politics and all sorts of things in, but before we sort of do a round table, I just wanted to sort of say that one of my favorite moments in the film, and this is like a real smile all the way around my face moment. Once again, in gangster films, the bad guys or the good guys, they go for their guns and there's a big fight out. Shuji is not of the Yakuza. That's not his weapon of choice. His weapon of choice is to make people happy with his harmonica. This bit, very late in the film, where he gets on stage to play with the band and Tokiko calls out to him,
Shuji!
Down! So most harmonica players who play in blues bands will have a harp belt around them, each in a different key. She takes the belt out and throws it at him, which he catches. And it's sort of like she's throwing him his guns, like in a gangster. Hey, gangster, here, grab your gun. You're ready to fight. And I just thought that
I got to be honest.
You didn't
that? Go on, Morris. I thought that was awful. I thought that was just, that went way too far into blues traveler territory. Never cool, man. Never cool.
I'm sorry. I got to say, I absolutely loved it.
Fair play.
Call corny, corny or not, I just thought it just happened to suit that particular moment in the film in light
it
of
did.
What
yeah,
happened
yeah.
You know, at a particular point afterwards. So it was just like to say, right, he'd just gone through this horrific experience, and yeah, it could have been more honest and a little bit, well, yeah, go up and play your set with the band. But I really loved it. I mean, maybe I just like cornball, but I thought it was a great moment.
Yeah,
I loved it.
It was super corny and it worked because of that, but it's just me being a bit...
get off
bit
my
of a naysayer. Yeah, yeah. I was quickly going to say as well, this is a bit of a superficial observation, but this is such a super 90s looking film. Everybody is dressed like... Oh, Shuji only seems to have this giant oversized orange t-shirt, baggy jeans and white trainers. Kenji's kind of henchman, his right-hand man, has got the most 90s looking sports jackets I've ever seen on a person. Right. A couple of the bands that play, there's this kind of, I suppose, laid-back jazz funk hip-hop band that play, and their singer looks like the love child of Jamiroquai, and I don't know what the hell he was wearing, man, but
Quest or something like
yeah that was something else. So the aesthetic screams 90s, but that's certainly not to its detriment. Is, you know, very much anchors it in a place and time, doesn't it?
No, you can definitely see, yeah, it reeks. It's just seeped in 90s, you know. And yeah, it's just TG sitting there playing Street Fighter in the arcade. And
I gotta be an anal video game there too. Him. He was playing Tekken. It wasn't Street Fighter.
Oh, it was Tekken? Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. And then I like that one bit where in other films you would say, yeah, my father's out of the scene. You know, he's gone. I don't know where he is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And his old man's just living right around the corner in a cardboard box. And I like there was the one bit where they were doing a breakdown of the song, and you see her moving in and setting up the house, and then you see them, you know, doing things together, and then you see him introducing her to his old man in the cardboard box. And then his dad's just like, I don't want anything to do with this shit, you know, like, you know, and closes the door. But it was just... yeah, that was hilarious. I was just like, man, like, that's
bizarre, wasn't it? Yeah.
So let's go around the table. Any final thoughts? Do you recommend the film?
Yeah, I would absolutely recommend this. I think that for people that go out and, I mean, for Mikkei, people that are interested in Mikkei, I think they're going to go initially for his more well-known, for his kind of his heavier hits, you know, like Audition and the other films that he did, or Ichi and all that. And then they can go back and sink into his variations, you know, and his ruminations on different things. But if this was the first Mikkei film you were to watch, and then you went into something like Ichi or something else, I think you would be like, what? Like, what the fuck? It's too much of a weird ride. But I think, like I said, if you go into his kind of more popular or his more out there things, and then you basically say, okay, this guy is wackier than the shithouse rat, he's just going to do what he wants to do, then you can sink into his different indulgences.
I really, really enjoyed this. I'm still thinking that you obviously were talking about it the next day. I watched it yesterday. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was laid in bed last night thinking about it. And when I was having breakfast this morning, I was thinking about it. There's a lot to chew on in this. And, you know, like Tim was saying, it's people who know Mikkei through the more transgressive, in-your-face stuff. I think this would be a real pleasant surprise, because it really shows Mikkei is, you know, an intelligent, thoughtful filmmaker. Yep. And he was way back at that point in his career. He wasn't just throwing the shit at the screen, as it were. You know, he's kind of a filmmaker's filmmaker, really, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I hadn't heard of this. I didn't know what to expect, but I very much enjoyed it. And it's something that I will return to again and again, I think. So I totally recommend it. I thought it was great.
It's certainly a film that does feature some of the backstabbing politics and almost Shakespearean violence of a Yakuza tale that we might be used to from some of Mikkei's other films, and from, you know, other films, you know, you might sort of think any of the films of Suzuki or Fukusaku. Mm-hmm. There's some of that violence. So it is typical in some ways, but it also shows a very personal side of these two outsiders. And I think one thing that we might not have mentioned is that Shuji is, inverted commas, you know, the good guy. Kenji, I like the fact that we get to see him in relation to Shuji, in relation to his affection for him, but he's a bad motherfucker Yakuza. He's never painted as a truly sympathetic character. He is a protagonist, but he's a guy who's a Yakuza for starters and a disloyal Yakuza.
Yeah.
So he's never painted in a fair way, but he's a well-rounded character. And
That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah.
I think that Mikkei does characterization very, very well. Yeah, he was to go to more transgressive places later on, but this is a superb film.
It goes back to what we were saying earlier about the idea of people's, you know, misconceptions of the definition of humanity. Kenji has human aspects to him, you know, and he has affection and he has certain things, but then he chooses to show more of his negative and aggressive nature than he does of his, he tries to be affectionate. He tries to kind of hint, you know, like, but it just doesn't work for him. And then finally, he just kind of accepts the way things are going to play out. And no spoiler, but even though he knows that things are not going to be reciprocated with Gigi, he still takes actions that shows that he still loves him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was, again, showing that he has humanity, you know, for a guy who's an absolute shit.
I think it speaks volumes of Mikke that he can take the kind of format of a Yakuza film, because, you know, at this point, how many hundreds of Yakuza films must there be out there, and actually turn in a really nice kind of, like you say, Morris, a character study, an intelligent piece of filmmaking, and bring something just new and interesting to the, I guess you could call it a Yakuza film.
There's enough of that in there. It's not just a tale of two guys with the Yakuza in the background. It is a Yakuza film, but there's a lot of depth to this. That sounds terrible, because that's to say that Yakuza films don't have depth, but which I'm certainly not, but this is a personal story and a Yakuza story. There's the Shakespearean politics part of it, but there's also the friendship part of it, but without it being a kitschy friendship story. There's just so much to this, and I really, really love this film. I'm so glad I discovered this and that we were able to talk about it on this program.
Is it just me, or did you guys get a feeling of like almost like Wong Kar Wai with this?
That's absolutely, and Wong Kar Wai actually made some tough crime films before he started doing things like In the Mood for Love,
right,
and the like. So yeah, definitely, I could see Wong Kar Wai having made a film like this for sure.
Like I see a little bit of almost like something like Chungking Express with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's a
relationship between Shuji and his girlfriend. Definitely, yeah.
When you think of the first half of Chungking Express, a lot of that choppy action with, I forgot the name of the actress, but you know, the actress who's wearing the blonde wig and the trench coat.
Right.
A lot of the action is filmed very choppily, just like in that opening scene in Blue's Harp with Kenji running from the other mob. I think there's a bit of a blue filter in both films. There's superficial comparisons, but overall, I think the mood that both filmmakers were going for was very, very similar. So I think that's a terrific call. All right, well, hopefully we've inspired you people out there to go search out this film if you haven't already done so. And if you have seen Blue's Harp before, then please feel free to write into us and tell us whether you agree or disagree or what things we might have missed out. We'd really love to hear from you. If you want to get in contact with us, you can write to us at seeherepodcast@gmail.com. You can join a very, very friendly Facebook group. We won't have any smart-ass people go and say any nasty passive-aggressive things like on, you know, some Facebook groups out there. We're all friendly. So facebook.com/groups/seeher. That's SEEHEAR. And please let your friends and enemies know that we exist.
Right.
So they can download and listen to us, because we have egos. We want people to listen and know that we exist. That's just who
we are.
Absolutely.
If you hear about any new films coming up in terms of music documentaries or music biopics or anything like that of any nature, please send us trailers and please let us know that things are on the horizon, because we're always looking forward to finding out about new things so we can contact people and get in touch with the directors. And it's just when you think that there'll never be a Captain Beefheart documentary, maybe there's one right around the corner that I don't know about. I'm just praying.
One film that we will be talking about next month and will be revealed right now will be told to us by Bernie, because you and I don't know what it is. So, Bernie, it's your pick next month. What are we going to be talking about?
Okay, well, we are going back to America next month, but we are going to America via Finland. We are going to be discussing Aki Kaurismäki's 1988 film, I think, Leningrad Cowboys Go America.
That's on my list of shame.
But do you know what? Me too. I've not seen it before, so this should be an interesting discussion. I've meant to see for years and years and years. So next month, we can finally get into it.
Thank you very much for suggesting that. Looking immensely forward to bringing that to the show next month. Anything else that we've done all the housekeeping? I think that's it. So you've got our recommendation. Search out this month's film. If you want to play along with us, search out next month's film, Leningrad Cowboys Go America, and we'll have a lot of fun. So until next month, please be nice to each other, because a lot of people out in the world are not being nice to each other. We have a good community. We have wonderful listeners. Please be nice to each other. Watch some great films. Pick up the harmonica. Learn how to play the harmonica. And
just don't wear a harmonica belt. Whatever you do.
Shut up.
And always remember out there, you know, it's okay once in a while to be an ass half, but don't be a hole.
See you next month, people. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.